is coming.
Welcome back, everybody, to Vassals of Kingsgrave for the next episode of our linear reread through A Song of Ice and Fire. This is, I believe, our 93rd episode. We're getting very close to being caught up here and ready for the Winds of Winter. We just finished a multi-part recap of Feast for Crows, what we think about the book in general there. And that means that we are done in the linear format with Feast of Crows. From here on out, it is all dance. And we will be figuring out if we're going to put the Winds of Winter chapters in or how we can slot those possibly, the preview chapters, towards the end of this. We'll see. So our last episode, we finished with Ario 1, the Watcher. And from there, we jump forward to, let's see, the events of this set of chapters take place from June 1st to the 14th of 300. My name is Adam. I'm also known as Drowned Snow on the Podcast of Ice and Fire forums. And today I am joined by Zach.
Hey, this is Alias in the forums. Glad to be back on the reread.
Hannah.
Shadow Baby on the forums.
Matt.
Farley on the forums.
And Michael.
Hey, Kyle Wadeggi on the forums.
All right, everybody. How's your afternoon treating you? Everybody doing good?
Yeah, I was just watching Into the Spider-Verse again and just remarking on how amazing that movie is. So
nice. I've seen that one dozens so of good. Times now. It's like one of my son's favorite movies, so he's just always playing it.
Your son and I are basically the same person.
Well, we've watched all of the classic like 90s Spider-Man cartoon series now, and we're watching the Spectacular Spider-Man cartoon series, which I'd never seen. We went and saw Far From Home twice in the theater. Like, he's like, Spider-Man is like his thing right now. So it's legit. Adorable.
Yeah.
Yep. I'm the proud papa. Anyway, let's get moving on here. So we've got three chapters to cover today. The first one is Tyrion 9 from Dance of Dragons. These are all from Dance of Dragons. The second is Griffin Reborn. It's John Connington's second chapter. And then we'll get to the first Cersei chapter of Dance. And catch up with her and see what's been going on. So our first chapter, Tyrion 9, and I believe... Is that you, Zach?
It's me.
That's my chapter.
I was just going to let you sweat through that. All right. Tyrion 9. So the chapter opens with Tyrion jousting against Penny as the cold, dead eyes of Tywin and Joffrey mock him from beyond the grave, while the sailors of the Selaesori Koran do the same. Tyrion does his best to play the part, but still no coins are thrown their way for their performance. The ship is becalmed, tempers are running high, and the stores of rum are running low. After the joust, Tyrion reveals to Jorah that he knows the knight's plan to get back into Daenerys' good graces. Jorah rewards him with a crack on the head. Penny comes and tends to him and warns him that he should not act that way around big people. Eventually, the wind finds the ship again, but there's a storm chasing behind it. While the storm rages, Penny surprises Tyrion with a kiss that he does not want, and she does not really want either. As the widow promised, the stinky steward never reaches its destination. Instead, the ship is wrecked by the storm and left adrift for 19 days. On the 20th day, they spot a ship coming their direction, a ship carrying slavers. All right, so of course... we are continuing Tyrion's miserable journey through Essos, which has just gone from bad to worse. It's not the most significant chapter of the book by any means, but what are people's general thoughts on this one? A good editor would have cut it, Matt, you think?
Yeah, I think so. Oh my God, like the whole... God damn it. It's just like a waste of time. The only cool part of any of these chapters is Mokoro.
Yeah, that one scene of him at the end, just in the storm with his arms stretched out, praying to the storm. That's a very cool image, for sure. And we'll see more of him later. But yeah, I have that same feeling as you, Matt, reading this. And it's that thing that I think, you know, for some people, obviously, they love Feast for Crows and Dance with Dragons. But that is a feeling that some of us have that kind of pervades these books, is that there's a lot of content in them that feels like it just runs on too long. There are scenes that feel like they're just purely for the sake of continuity and they don't have that same kind of impact. You know, there's some series of chapters in the books as a whole where it's like every chapter after another, it's just like amazing one after the other. And it feels like it's all building, but this is one that's more, you know, it's more just to kind of establish where we are. And it's continuing, of course, Tyrion's, you know, his rapidly descending, emotional state. That's definitely what's going on mainly. That's the main thrust of what we can think about with this chapter. Do we have any thoughts on just kind of where Tyrion's head is at this point?
Not kissing other dwarves.
Not great.
No, it's not good.
Well, Penny's, how old is Penny? She's fairly young, right? She's like teenager.
Yeah, and that's something that Tyrion remarks on in the chapter that I think is notable, right? Is that he thinks of Penny as this person who's so innocent, right? Someone who's been kind of uncorrupted by the situation she's in, which I think is kind of an interesting thing for Tyrion to observe, right? Because, you know, Tyrion is being so hard on himself right now. He's really obviously down in the dumps at this point. He thinks his life is so awful, but he sees someone like Penny who honestly has it a lot worse than him, right? Because she has the trifecta, right? She's not just a dwarf, but she's also, you know, a person of the small folk. She's a commoner, and she's also a woman. So her life in this world is not easy. And I wonder if eventually, it doesn't seem like it's happened now, but eventually Tyrion will recognize, like, God, I actually have it pretty good with everything that I've been through, and maybe I should, you know, pick myself up and stop being such a shithead.
I don't think that'll happen
for a lord, but I think though we do see a little bit of his like signs that maybe he's got hope coming in the future in this chapter, just with the Penny stuff, because of the development we get for her a little bit, just showing you know, like the way she thinks about the big people, and like she's just basically afraid of the world just because that's, you know, her situation in life, unfortunately. But Tyrion at least is still smart enough to try and, you know, protect the pig and the dog. And he doesn't really want to, he lies to her about the kiss, even though he's like, I'm not into this. But he's like, oh, that was very nice, you know. So there are still signs that, you know, he's not a complete lost cause at the moment.
Yeah, but I agree, Adam, but I feel like it's just too blatant that she's supposed to be this foil and we're supposed to start to feel like sympathy and, you know, for her, but like Winds comes out, it turns out, you know, she gets trampled by the horse in like the battle for Marine. Does anyone get it?
Yeah, like, that's the question, right? Where is this going? It's
very forced,
right?
Like, we're supposed to care for this character because she's like trying to bring out Tyrion's humanity again, and I just don't.
I guess I didn't feel like it was gonna go anywhere, or it has to. I mean, if she dies off screen and Tyrion's upset, I mean, that's about the most I would expect, but. I mean, who knows?
Yeah, and in a way, even if Tyrion learns nothing from this, that's kind of an interesting progression of his arc. It's that kind of thing where, like, all these people enter Tyrion's life that are, like, trying to help him or just in some way trying to influence him in a positive way, and he's just, like, steadfastly battling all that back and refusing to change. I don't know. I think that's actually a pretty interesting piece of his development as a character, but we'll see. I mean, I think it's very possible she actually does survive and she continues through the story. So I'm not sure where that's going, but it'll be.
You think she would follow him somewhere potentially?
Yeah, but potentially he could. I mean, she could be his redemption. I don't. It could go that way. I don't necessarily think it will, but I think it's on the table.
Or maybe he just.
So Penny sits the Iron
to
Throne.
Take her under his wing.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. She's the queen coming soon. Gosh. For sure. Yeah,
but they still have to tilt for Cersei.
Yes.
Maybe
both. We'll see. Yeah, it's I mean, I think I actually kind of think it's a good thing that, you know, I talked about the last time I was on one of these. I don't know if it was the last Tyrion chapter, but it's the one where they're talking to the widow and he's so obsessed with Cersei in that one. And she's constantly thinking about how he's going to kill her. And I actually think it was a little better in this chapter. Like, he's not thinking about Cersei really at all in this chapter. Instead, he's thinking about Shay and Tywin a lot. Which to me, like, I think he's starting to feel some guilt over that, which I think is actually a good thing. That's still something on his mind, and he's not moved past that entirely.
Hands of gold.
Yeah. So hopefully he'll come around on that as well. I mean, there's not much more to this chapter, obviously. I thought it was funny. We actually got a returned reference to Tyrion's acrobatic skills that come up early in the series. We got the mention of him cartwheeling across the tables of Casterly Rock. So that is not something that George cut. It's still in there. He actually was a acrobatic master.
Oh man,
is this gonna be like the shortest reread episode ever? Because
could be
my chapter takes 2 seconds. So.
I don't know about that. We'll see. We'll see about
it
that.
It could be. Yeah, I mean. There's not a lot to this chapter. It's not terrible, but
the last thing I wanted to check in on was how are people feeling about Jorah at this point.
Oh, yeah.
He's a piece of shit.
He could just go away.
Jesus, Michael, tell us how you really feel.
No, that's basically all I have. I just think he's so humorless. And when Tyrion is, you know, explaining how the situation really is and all he can do is punch Tyrion, I'm just like, God. You're a piece of best. Shit. That's really all I think.
The Jorah's just like, he needs to be thrown off the boat at this point, but oh well.
What is it? In the show, Tyrion says, like, long brooding silences and physical violence, the Mormont way.
Yeah, I don't know how you would know that, but yeah, I guess so. Yeah, I mean, Jorah, he is what he is, and he's obviously he's also kind of at his emotional down point here. I think it's going to get worse in the next chapter when they're both enslaved, of course, and he's just kind of dead inside, but he's not in a good place, Jorah, and we'll see if he can crawl his way out of that. And if there's any kind of hope for him as a character moving forward.
Yeah, but I really like that for him. Like, I just always thought, like, at some point he should get enslaved because it's like, here's what you did, you little fucker.
Yeah, everyone deserves to be enslaved at some point in lives. Teach them some humility, you know?
Well, no, because he's...
I agree.
That's,
so there's
that's why he's exiled. So...
True, yes. He experienced it. That's true. That's a good point.
And yeah, like, so Bina has a couple of notes here. One of them, and I'm sure many of you know, that some of the books were split into two volumes outside the U.S. So in her version of A Dance with Dragons, it's two volumes, and this chapter is actually the last chapter of the first volume. So she's not sure if there's any like significance to that or just sort of kind of where the chapters cut. Well, I don't know. It's not like any kind of ending or turn or anything, so... I don't know.
Do you know why they did that?
Do you know why they did the two volumes, you mean?
Uh-huh.
Money? I don't know.
I think for the paperback just, is... Yeah,
can't take the full page length of A Dance with Dragons.
It's too girthy.
This is a great question. Like, we need to understand how books are made.
Yes, hashtag explain to me.
Yeah.
Because Storm of Swords, in America... Obviously.
Is paperback, you know, split?
One volume.
Is it split? Because my Storm of Swords is one volume.
No, but it's across the seas. For some reason, they did this with, I think, Storm and Dance and maybe versions of Feast. But I know I've seen Storm and Dance where they're two different volumes. And I just assumed it had something to do with the publishing in Europe or something, like something they're accustomed to. I don't really know. Because I've never seen that in any bookstore here. But
yeah,
I have to think part of it is that people are just daunted by reading like a 1,000-page book, so they just cut it up so it's not as intimidating.
Yeah, that might be what it is. I mean, I don't know if they're sold necessarily like together or separately or how it works.
Is it Feast also 1,000 pages long?
Yeah,
Feast is a little smaller. Like, God, I was gonna say Feast could have been longer, but
Feast is only one Lord of the Rings. It's just one Lord of the Rings.
Actually, it's like two.
So, okay, here's my other question: were they published at the same time, or did they have to wait?
No. It was published like when the book came out. You know, whenever they released this edition, there were just two volumes to it. It wasn't like.
You had to wait for the other volume.
I'm not sure about that. I don't know if both the volumes came together. I mean, I would kind of think that, or if you had to pay extra. I'm not sure. I just know I've seen a lot of people that have like the two volumes of Storm and of Dance. So, anyway, that's I'm sure someone listening to this is screaming right now, with the obvious answer that we don't know.
It's a book owner or two.
Greg for sure.
Greg, just go back 5 minutes ago and skip all this. It's fine.
Yeah. So Bina also mentions, we've sort of covered this a little bit, that it's weird that Tyrion retains his humanity with Penny and kind of being a little protective of her, but doesn't really have any remorse over killing Shay or Tywin. So I think he maybe has a little bit of remorse over that, but I don't know. It's such a complicated decision because his dad kind of deserves it, and I mean we'll hear in the next chapter the way Tywin operated, and of course we know the way Tywin treated him. Shay And that's just Tyrion was punishing himself for that more than anything, for being an idiot. Anyway.
I think in the past, Tyrion has always demonstrated this very definite black and white idea of who is worthy of his pity, depending on people that have wronged him and people that have not. Like when I remember he gazes at Grandmaster Pye's cell after he puts him in the black cells and he's like, yeah, take that, you piece of shit. And I've always felt kind of sorry for Pye's cell, but not Tyrion.
Huh.
Yeah. He's definitely a vengeful little asshole. I mean, he does not let shit go.
But yeah, Shay, Tywin, they've all wronged him, whereas Penny hasn't specifically wronged him as of yet.
There's still time. Oh, goodness. All right, we ready to move on?
I'm just thinking about how Penny's going to betray him now.
Well, everyone knows the prophecy.
When they split the book up, they gave it two different names. I'm sorry, I'm tripping on that. Dreams and Dust.
Yeah,
it's called Dreams and Dust and After the Feast.
That's weird.
Are the two volumes.
Yeah, because most of the back half is stuff that's after Feast. And actually, literally, it is. Because in the linear timeline, we just finished Feast in the last reread. Interesting. So,
that lines up. That is interesting. It still doesn't say why, though.
I feel like we should call this the After the Feast reread now.
Probably should. Speaking of after things, after Tyrion 9, we jump a whole 20 chapters and 120 pages ahead to The Griffin Reborn, which is John Connington's second chapter. And this guy moves quick. This takes place, this is actually about 2 weeks after the Tyrion chapter we just read. And that is going to be Varley with the chapter he was extremely excited to cover.
I really was, guys, and I kind of misremembered this entire thing because I thought there was a lot more backstory on the Conningtons. I thought there was a lot more, like, this is where we find out, like, John Connington was totally gay for Rhaegar, and I didn't get that this time. I don't know what happened. So I guess presumably the storm that wrecked Tyrion also scattered their fleet, and the Golden Company's fleet, and they're all over the place. And within a couple of days, they've already taken over 3 minor castles, including the Griffin's Roost, the ancestral home of John Connington. Basically, they take it with very little resistance. They set up shop. He kind of just takes over the place. They're making plans. He goes up to his tower spire where he remembers looking over his lands with his father and then later on with Rhaegar and has like a conversation with him and then, you know, thinks that as Bina wrote down, he says to himself, I rose too high, loved too hard, dared too much. I tried to grasp a star and overreached and fell. And as she asks, like, who talks to themselves like that, I have no idea. But is that supposed to be the only evidence that we have that John really loved Rhaegar in a sexual and not martial or, you know, as a brother-in-arms kind of a way? I don't know. So Harry Strickland's still a pussy and is bitching about elephants. And at the very end, Fagon comes up with Sir Duck and he says he wants to lead the assault on Storm's End. And that's it.
With this chapter, was anyone else when they first read it like, holy shit, that was easy? I felt like it came really quick, them landing after, like, so long of not anyone getting anywhere. It was just like, whoa, they actually made it.
Yeah, I like the dude that threw cold oil on them. That was pretty awesome.
Yeah.
How awkward when it's just like, oh, that did nothing.
My bad.
The cauldron caused more damage. I love it.
That was good. So
greasy.
It was like a trombone slide.
Yeah, there's something kind of just funny about how efficient the Golden Company is, just like ruthlessly taking over this castle and just catching them unawares. Although, you know, there are some problems. They don't have elephants. Their ships are all over the place.
No,
which is a big problem.
Which is a huge deal.
Harry is pissed.
Their people are just getting dropped off everywhere, which is actually kind of low key a great strategy, it turns out. Because he's what if people hear about them landing? They'll just hear about Raiders landing. Yeah. They're kind of like, we probably should have done this in the first place.
And all I kept on thinking was, I think they mentioned like the Crow's Nest or something, which is the castle of House Morgan. And wasn't Morgan the guy with a pet monkey in Renly's army?
That's Mark Mullendore.
God damn it. So I was...
You're almost there.
All these M's.
There's M's involved, yeah. And way to remember for both of you. Holy crap, I've completely forgot about a pet monkey.
I didn't even know there was a monkey in the whole series. I'm blown away.
I agree.
Wait until we get Bravo. To Victarion's chapter with the monkeys throwing their shit.
And Victarion hates the monkeys, which is my favorite detail ever.
He hates everything, though. Let's
he
be
thinks
honest.
They're laughing at him. But sorry, this isn't related to the chapter.
So the does anyone have anything to say about the chapter? Because I could talk about monkeys instead.
Yeah, so I mean, we talk about Red Ron at Connington, and we realize that like the Conningtons actually had a significant, you know, land holding. They were for like a long time.
But 50 generations, which I calculated out to be 1,500 years or so. That's a good stretch of land ownership.
Crazy. And they have a huge castle still, but they're just like, you know, the knight of the castle, which is kind of like, okay. usually when you dethrone like a powerful lord like that, you give their castle to someone else and maybe you give them a smaller castle, but I don't know. Maybe no one wanted Griffin's Roost or it doesn't matter. But it's just, it's interesting to hear, you know, what kind of person this was, you know, and it makes sense that how close he was to the prince and all that kind of, you know, makes a little more sense. But then he does mention his failure to capture Robert and how Tywin would have just burned everything to the ground and killed everyone and been like, all right, we're good.
Like, did I misremember? Didn't they go over in more detail in one of his chapters, like the Battle of the Bells and and his relationship with Rhaegar?
I think because this is the one.
That's where you're more getting the he's totally gay for him.
No, so, I think it's all in this chapter.
Yeah, this is the first time it comes up.
Yeah,
with
the
him.
Stuff with Rhaegar, I don't think you ever get a ton of that. Like, we've extrapolated a lot, but.
Okay,
I mean, this is his only POV, correct? Or am I way off?
He has no, one
he this is his second chapter.
Like, oh, okay.
He's always talking about the fucking bells in that one chapter, and I—that's what I thought that was about.
Right, it's actually explained in this one what he's talking about. Yeah.
Anyway, I misremembered. I thought there was a lot more juicy stuff here, but you know, I don't think John is sexually in love with Rhaegar. I think it's a commander kind of subservient.
Well, that would be really weird because he's dead.
We discussed this in the Gaze Night Out podcast that he, is absolutely not prescient and aware of his sexuality. And so this is something that's much more homosocial and romantic rather than overtly sexual.
Huh. Like, see, I'm getting like a Sam Frodo kind of love vibe here. Like,
but I'm your John.
But seriously, who refers to their prince as, oh, my silver prince? Like
Sansa would.
Well, Sansa would, but... And additionally, in this chapter, he reminisces on the wedding with Elia, and Jon was pissed off, and he's like,
yeah,
Elia
she was
never
not good
deserved
enough for him.
Yeah. Like,
there's something going on. I think it would be very short-sighted to not think that at the very least it was a very strong connection, and just the fact that he ruminates about it constantly.
Yeah,
it's very much a thing.
And his little remark about Elia not being good enough, I really expected, I guess, and again, this is just me misremembering the chapter, that maybe he would have brought up something about Lyanna in that business. Maybe like she was more worthy and that's why, you know, Rhaegar, and we get a little insight into that whole episode, but no, we didn't.
Well, clearly no woman is good enough for Rhaegar.
Yeah, the interesting thing about that too is it feels very one-sided to me. You know, it feels like, you know, Jon Con is all in all these kind of ways hoping that he'll be recognized by Rhaegar, but at this point it's not clear that ever happens. So that might be part of the resentment.
Well,
there.
Rhaegar is just kind of an asshole that doesn't communicate with anyone. Now,
that's the interesting thing I wanted to talk about, right? You know, this is a thing that comes up a lot, right? It's like, what is the deal with Rhaegar? Is he a good guy? Is he a shitty guy? And I think here we get some more ammunition for the fact that he is kind of just like a weird dude living in his own world and not really caring about anyone else, including people like Elia and Lyanna. It seems like he's kind of just using them as broodmares because he has this prophecy he needs to fulfill. We see here mentioned that Jon Kahn says that Elia could never, you know, bear a child again after Aegon, so he just moves on to someone else who could bear a child and complete his prophecy. That seems to be the motive.
I think that Rhaegar had good motives for certain things. Like, he wants the realm to be stable. He wants there to be peace. He wants to save the world and all that. But he's kind of like your, I don't know, you're like, you know, like on the spectrum type of guy that just sort of is not, he doesn't really understand social cues so much, maybe.
Yeah,
like,
I feel the same.
His father's burning people and he's like, right, but I'll get to that later. I'm kind of in the middle of something, you know. He like runs off with Lyanna and it's like starts a war, and he's like, well, whatever, I'm busy, like when I come back it'll be fine, like, you know. It's like, it reminds me of the way they portrayed like Mark Zuckerberg in like the Facebook movie, and just being like kind of like a you know, like everything I do is destined. Yeah, like you're wasting my time, like not necessarily like I want to do bad things or anything like that, but like, here's what I'm doing, get on board, and if you don't understand it, well, what the fuck's wrong with you, you know?
I think of Rhaegar the same way. I think he just doesn't have that kind of consciousness of social cues and social situations, which doesn't make him a bad guy. It just makes him the, you know, the kind of person he is, and unfortunately it means that he does end up using people seemingly like Jon Kahn, like Elia and like Lyanna, and you know, they may have this love for him, but it doesn't, I don't necessarily think it's back, and maybe it is love in his own weird way, but
right,
because that kind of reminds me of how Renly is too with
Renly gets people, like Renly knows how to work people, and yeah, I think he's odd,
charismatic, but I think he's really selfish and kind of like
right
shallow, you know.
I think that the odd part about Rhaegar is that he is a very charismatic person in a way, depending on who you talk to, obviously, but because he's very attractive and he's very talented, and the stuff he does, like, inspires people, I guess you'd say. So, like, he understands, or maybe he's just not even doing it intentionally, but...
Even Ned and Robert don't have, like, bad things to say about him outside the whole show.
Right. So, like there's definitely a charisma to him, but there's not... like a social awareness. There's not.
He's like, not a player of the game.
His social IQ is low.
Yeah,
I think that's just
emotional like
Targaryen,
intelligence.
Exceptionalism that is like Don. It's like the free range of that whole family to do like, you know, whatever the fuck they want.
Yeah, he's charismatic in like the most purest sense, where he has like an aura about him. Like there's actually just something magnetic about him that you can't explain. It's not anything he does specifically, I don't think, but there's just, that's the interpretation I get, is that there's just something about him that draws people.
He's not like the Tony Robbins, like rah-rah, like guy that's out there like, engendering that feeling in people through speeches and through like well-practiced, you know, rhetoric or anything like that. He's just sort of the guy that carries it.
And there's something even about the distance that he probably shows with people that even makes him more magnetic, I think. I think that's definitely a thing. I do want to talk, you know, I was mentioning this a little bit in the chat. There are like a handful of characters where I do think both, you know, in terms of us as readers of the story and also, you know, characters in the text, I think there are some characters where their tale kind of grows in the telling. And of course, Rhaegar is one of them. And it's interesting that a lot of these characters are connected. Like characters like Jon Kahn, who, you know, you mentioned, Varley, you thought of this chapter much more highly than you actually experienced when you actually went back and read it. And there's this like feeling that like Jon Kahn is like this very significant, important figure, but really he seems like just a guy, kind of a, you know, weird guy when you read the chapter. And there's him, there's Rhaegar, there's people like Arthur Dayne, of course, in the Tower of Joy thing that we kind of mythologize as this great figure, this great warrior. You know, if we were doing like a power ranking of knights, he'd probably come up pretty high, even though we've never seen him fight, really. And of course, Lyanna as well as one of those people. And Ashara Dayne, you know, all these people that we really don't know anything about, but really people really love in the fandom, don't you think?
I think that's deliberate romanticism on George's part, where all the dead characters are remembered as better than they were. Like when Robert sees Lyanna's statue and it's like, oh, she was more beautiful than that. And yeah. Like, yeah, of course, Robert.
The funny thing is that we can be conscious of that as readers, that that is the tactic George is using, but we still fall into those same traps very frequently. We still think of Lyanna, you know, in that way. It's strange how it works that well.
George has suckered us in.
Yeah.
We want to believe some of these things, obviously. I mean, the writing is very effective.
Yeah, there's this sort of awe appreciation I think we have that is mirrored by characters that, you know, remark on these great noble figures when the realm used to be, you know, a noble place before it fell into ruin. But really what it is that it's just mythologizing the past, right? It was always the way it is now. We just have this lens into the current reality that just feels more mundane because that's where we're at. And that's why I think this chapter is interesting, right? Because Jon Kahn kind of is a part of that mythical past, but he's the only one who kind of made it out of that. You know, you could also say people like Ned, but he made it out of it. And that's why he seems so mundane when you actually go and read what he's doing now. He's like not as interesting as like he's made out to be in all these stories.
Make the realm
great
again.
So how long do you think he lasts? How long do you think he lasts into winter?
I think he's going down when King's Landing blows up. That's my suspicion.
You don't think his grayscale is going to do anything? Because it's like the grayscale doth protest too much.
Is serving to accelerate his actions, where he's always thinking in this chapter, fuck you, homeless Harry Strickland, we need to move and do stuff. I mean, he'd think that anyway, but it's making him think, you know, oh, I should have burnt down.
Right. It might make him make mistakes or hasty alliances or something. And I feel like it's more of a narrative device than like what's going to actually be a huge problem for him. I don't think he'll live long enough for the grayscale to really be too significant.
I'm kind of more, I don't know if it's going to be like the full scale epidemic thing that people theorize, but I'm kind of more with Varley that I feel like there's so much mention of grayscale. It has to be like a significant part of what happens in some degree. I don't know. I feel like it has to have some impact.
I'm undecided if John Connington will be the main vector or if Shireen will be the main vector.
Reactivating that.
Yeah.
Shireen is fine, guys. She's had
That's
it for
not what
she's
Val
fine.
Thinks.
Wildlings don't know anything. It is known. Dun, 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 dun.
Yeah, but isn't it like if you do survive that long, then it's
dormant. Yeah.
Yeah,
like,
right.
There's a lot of conflicting answers about grayscale in the books, but like the narrative around Shireen seems to be sort of like the chicken pox thing, like, oh, you had it as a kid and like you're kind of fine, but you get it as an adult, you're fucked, sort of thing. So
she'll get shingles.
Yeah, it's already in you. I've seen the posters. Oh man.
All right, I got a couple weird ones on this chapter. Is anyone else suspicious of a Duckfield, the Kingsguard guy? I feel like it's the same kind of doth protest too much thing. Like, why is he getting so much screen time? I'm kind of suspicious that something's going to happen with that dude.
I think he's going to go down swinging, trying to protect Fagon there with the storming of Storm's End. And I don't know. I'm not too suspicious of him. I kind of like him.
I'm keeping an eye on Duckfield is all I'm saying.
I mean, Tyrion liked him. More or less.
Well,
so,
first of all, that's obviously like a bullshit name.
It's definitely an alias. Yeah. It's not really his name. Oh yeah, he's undercover for sure.
In a field when he was being definitely, knighted. That's where it comes from.
Yes, totally.
I'm with you. I think he's shifty.
Keep an eye out for Duck.
Well, he's a little too like all over the place as well. Like, having you noticed, like he's always kind of there in the background lurking, and I just don't.
Yeah, no, I don't
I don't trust like anyone at this point who's like everywhere like that. You know,
haven't they already bad vibes. Storm's End in the preview chapter?
It's reported secondhand.
We didn't see what happened or know if that's true, but it's reported that suddenly they've got Storm's End too. You know. Like pretty soon they'll just be in the Red Keep. Like, jeez.
These guys are doing work. Yeah. So I have a hypothetical. Would you rather find someone that looks at you the way that Jon Kahn looks at Rhaegar, or the way that homeless Harry looks at elephants? Which would you?
Fuck, that's a good one.
Yeah.
Elephants, because Jon Kahn is just creepy.
Well, I don't know. Harry's kind of creepy too. I don't know how.
We don't see Harry's reaction to that one elephant that comes up with Fagon. I think if, like, you know, he bursts in his pants or something, you know,
And then we want to be here
looking at an elf.
Our answers.
Connington can look, but he can't touch.
Is
Harry definitely
is it this chapter, the last one, where he's looking at his arm and he's like, no, I'm fine. I've got like half a year or two or five, like maybe 10.
No, this one he's like, I should chop off my fingers. Oh, no, then I'd have to explain why I'm missing two fingers.
Hide your fingers. I don't know.
It just goes so quickly from like, I've got a few months to like, I'll be fine.
Yep. Yeah, denial is powerful. Yeah, I mean, how long does it take for like the stone men to become crazy and all that? Really, I don't know.
I guess when it gets to your brain, is the I don't know how long that takes.
Yeah. You got that stone fever. All right.
So speaking of denial, my favorite line in this chapter is, "But Rhaegar's eyes were dark indigo, darker than this boy's." Interpret that as you will.
Well, Rhaegar was pure Targaryen, and this boy is Dornish and Targaryen. Do we still think it's fake? It's a fake Aegon?
Yeah, for sure.
That's what this line would imply.
Blackfyre.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I don't.
I think it just makes it... why introduce the Blackfyre? I mean, sure, it could just be world building, but I feel like this is the way that they get introduced into the story, their involvement.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that it doesn't really matter because this guy's not going to be it either way. We're not going to see him as, like, Azor Ahai or sitting the throne at the end or anything like that. But I think the most significant part about him is what it means for Dany's story and like Illyrio's setup and all that. Like what kind of happened with that? Like if this was Illyrio's plan all along, sort of thing. So
okay,
what's motivating them
in the wars? Yeah. In like during the Wars of the Roses, when Henry Tudor was on the throne after Richard III, or Richard of York, I mean, there was like a dude that claimed to be other Richard.
Yeah, there are a couple that were supposed to be the princes in the tower that escaped, but really they don't know what happened to them. But yeah, they figured that they were imposters.
So it's like, for me with Vagon, it would kind of depend on how you look at that. Like if you think that that was an imposter, or perhaps the real prince. You know,
there are certainly many imposters popping up in history, in like medieval warfare and stuff. So yeah. I'm sure George is taking inspiration here.
Yeah, but I mean, there's like people that were close to that family back then that are like, I don't know. I'm not even sure.
Yeah, but I mean, this is a Targaryen. So like he has violet eyes and the silver hair. So, I mean, there are like certain specific tells that would give this one away.
No, that's what I'm saying is like the boy that his name was like Percival or something, or Pate, I don't know.
And
he came from France, you know, like it could have been, you know. And then when they did that show, I think it was in the show, like was their take on it, which I liked because, you know, you don't know and it would make sense.
Yeah, like, no one in this world has any way of really confirming this shit. I mean, you know, with the Targaryens, like Daenerys, you can look and go, well, look at the hair and the eyes, and that's sort of what they are going to do with him, because that's a fairly significant feature, but that still doesn't prove anything.
Yeah, no, because not every Targaryen has the white hair, and everyone knows that.
Right, there's no DMV photos, no one has Facebook to be like, that's not the guy. Like, even 20, 30 years ago, like, in our world, like, there are people that were like, wait, who are you? You know, like, they just change their name and get a new social security number, and, like, no one could check up on it. Like,
more proof for Duckfield. So, right there.
It's Perkin Warbeck was the imposter.
Perkin,
Before Bina loses her mind listening to this podcast.
Sorry. I'm going to get a phone call.
How dare you?
Let me just set it straight for you across the pond.
All right. Let's move on before we like discuss the entire War of the Roses. Okay.
There's a podcast out there, right? Didn't we do that at one point or something?
That was one of our like, I think early it was one of the first ones, which was
that Bino did.
Yeah. Still gets comments from
on that angry people.
On the War of the Roses. And I think it's influences on Game of Thrones.
Comparing to Ice of Fire. That was one of the early VOKs. So after the Griffin Reborn, we jump back 6 chapters, 100 pages in the book, to Cersei's first chapter, which is the same day, basically, June 14th. So...
Okay, Michael? Cersei 1. Yes. The nights grow colder as Cersei waits for Jaime. Though she has food, water, and a bed, each hour the scepters come in and ask her to confess to her sins, forcibly waking her if she is asleep. She reflects on the various men who have betrayed her in her eyes and wonders if Jaime has abandoned her as well. As the days progress, Cersei begins to succumb to the effects of her imprisonment and realizes she must confess and be with Tommen. She is taken to the High Septon, where she confesses to bedding Lancel and all 3 Kettleblack brothers, but denies responsibility for the murders of King Robert, the former High Septon, the framing of Margaery Tyrell, as well as denying her incestuous relationship with Jaime. For the crimes that she has denied, Cersei will face a trial by faith, but is permitted a more comfortable room for her confessions. The next day, she is visited by Kevin, who brings hard tidings. Jaime has vanished in the Riverlands. Sellswords are landing in the Stormlands, presumably in the service of Stannis. Mace Tyrell has been made Hand of the King, and although he possesses the strength to deal with this invasion, he refuses to move against them until Margaery is proven innocent. Cersei is accused of deicide, regicide, and incest, and will be executed should she be found guilty. If she wishes to leave the Sept of Baelor, she must additionally make a walk of atonement for her sins. Finally, Balon's Swan has sent news from Dorne, telling of Myrcella's maiming and the death of Aerys Okart. Cersei seizes on the death of Aerys, as a new member of the Kingsguard must now be installed. Fearing being overheard, Cersei instructs Kevin to bring a white cloak to Qyburn and simply to tell him that the time has come. So this is Cersei in A Dance with Dragons.
Never has the death of a Kingsguard been, like, so well received.
Yes, so she's like,
finally, someone's died. And I like all of the early scenes of torture in this where they're just like, they won't let her sleep.
Which, like, you know, that's an effective form of torture.
It is. And sleep deprivation is terrible.
And yeah, unlike what, really like, well Qyburn has done to the Blue Bard, where, like, you can see he's missing an eye and stuff, you know, the Faith can be like, oh, no, we're keeping Cersei in a nice cell. She's fine, and she's clearly losing her mind.
No bruises, you know. Yeah. I think it's great, because in some ways, as the reader, you're like, oh, yeah, Cersei deserves this shit. But it's pretty terrible to do that to anyone. But
I don't know if anyone really feels like fully sympathetic for Cersei here, but it really is a great, you know, case study as a writer of like how you kind of role reverse when you make her the POV and you show all the bad shit happening to her and how she's obviously Cersei is a bad person, but so is the High Septon, you know, he's also an asshole, and the Faith itself is, you know, kind of a fucked up institution. And you see her feeling the brunt of that, and you kind of, I kind of do feel bad for her, you know, that she's being tortured. It's not nice.
I don't.
I don't feel bad for her at all, but I do feel concerned about, like, what the fuck's going. Why would a church have cells? Like, there's your first clue. I just, like,
what. So there's a thing called the Inquisition? And that had lots of torture cells, and
Europe. Like, it's just insane.
Nobody expected the Faith Militant.
It's like having a smoking lounge in a hospital. You just don't. Like, the two don't go together.
Well, maybe these are makeshift cells.
I actually think it's kind of impressive how Cersei, and it actually kind of speaks to her just like overwhelming hatred and willingness to venge herself on anyone who does her wrong. But the fact that she doesn't like fully break through all of this is kind of impressive in terms of just how, you know, how strong that feeling of like, I will not let them see my tears, all this kind of stuff. Like, she is just like so prideful and so unwilling to to do that, and it's all an act still through all this. Like, any contrition she has, all fake. It's she is really hateful.
One of the best parts of the chapter is when she just sort of, like, she's being tortured and she's just comes to the realization, well, I just need to confess. And she, like, puts on the act. It's like, I'm ready to confess. And they just leave her alone and she sleeps for the night, you know. But then, of course, you know, she doesn't intend to actually do anything but confess to what they already know.
Yeah, she's very smart in taking the things she knows she can't deny, and obviously not confessing to the things that are going to get her killed.
If you were in her position, would you do the walk of shame?
I've done the walk of shame many a time.
I ain't ashamed. If you're just a normal person, you can walk through the streets buck naked, like, and people would just laugh and not care. But as the queen, and she views herself as the queen, like, it's the power base that she's wanting to establish is going to be significantly compromised by the walk of shame.
And I also think it's kind of like a dumbass move on their part too, because it's like just with anything else that's royal, you know, when you undercut the sovereignty, you undercut the whole reasoning behind, like, why the hell your entire life is the way it is. You know what I mean? Like, they're
right, but they want people they want people to believe in the faith. Like, they're trying to usurp the crown anyway.
But the faith only has, like, power and autonomy and influence over the masses from
temporarily
down, you know.
But their mandate comes from the seven. So that's, I mean, this is how in history, this is how this sort of thing has worked before, you know. So they view that, you know, their mandate comes from God, and they get enough power and enough freedom to expand their power from the local government, and they use that to essentially become the power, which I think is probably their goal.
In terms of Cersei's, you know, character and her choice to do the walk, it's funny, right? Because it seems kind of antithetical to who she is. You know, I just talked about how prideful she is, and she would never be willing to, you know, like, show herself like that openly like that, and, you know, debase herself in that way. But I almost feel like Cersei is so prideful that she just, like, doesn't care. She just, like, doesn't care what people think of her. She doesn't care if they see her like that. It goes to such a degree like that that it doesn't actually matter to her. She can, like, still be prideful. Her self-esteem is not damaged in any way by that experience.
Well, you don't think so? I mean, in her next POV, I think she breaks.
Well, temporarily, but I'm assuming that she'll recover.
Oh, I think she's all fucked up.
I don't think so. I think she'll be fine.
She certainly thinks at the start of the walk, you know, this will not break me. They think it will, but I'm going to be above that.
By the end, she's hallucinating faces and...
Oh, yeah. I mean, she may fall apart in that moment.
She's a giant zombie.
Yeah, but that's like when you jump across, like, a big chasm and you're like, I'm going to make it. I got it. I'm going to fucking make it. You know what I mean? Like, she's just psyching herself up, but she's screwed up. That's just messed up.
She's messed up, obviously, but I think her pride will be intact moving forward. I think this was will be a very temporary blow to that.
You see, I think, like, the last chapter in Dance shows her, like, completely broken and humbled. So it'd be interesting to see what her first POV and wins is going to be like, whether she is broken or she still has that Lannister pride. Because, I mean, if she didn't learn anything from this whole experience, then that's just shitty writing.
If I don't think so. The way she acts in this chapter, where she's acting all humble and, oh, I have sinned, I need to atone, I think that's very applicable to the epilogue chapter, where she's also putting on a front. And I think she will grow or change as a character, and that she's going to be, like, messed up, and her perception of reality will be changed, but just her pride is still there.
Yeah, she may be more, you know, more delusional, more hateful, and just more twisted, but I don't think that she's humbled. And I don't think that's bad writing. I you know, there people don't necessarily change, you know, like, they can go through a dramatic experience like this, and it doesn't necessarily have to change them. I don't think that makes it a static character, like a bad character or a poorly constructed character. Some people are just who they are.
No, that's true. I mean, I thought she was all fucked up before, and I just think she's, like, double and triple fucked up now. That's all.
Fair enough. Oh, she's definitely fucked up. I'm not
like, okay, here's the thing, too. I just think this whole thing is stupid. Like, it's just such a frustrating shit show because there's no good way this can play out. You cannot do that to a royal person and not have at least a good percentage of the small folks saying like, oh, well, she's just like us. So they're all just like us. So let's go burn that mother down. You know what I mean? Like that it can escalate so quickly. It's just not worth it at all. I mean, yes.
But isn't that exactly the sentiment that the High Sparrow and the Sparrows are trying to engender? They're trying to create that effect where people realize that they're actually
Bad for the monarchy, but good for the theocracy.
Down one institution to taking down the next one.
Well, no, because you know, like I forget who was saying it earlier, but basically the belief of the faith is that, you know, the mandate to rule is conferred upon the monarchy by their gods, and if they are unworthy, then perhaps the only thing that has, you know, significance or a mandate to rule are the people who serve the gods directly, and that the gods themselves are the only thing that are worthy of our
right
respect.
And what's easier to manipulate the people, the belief that like you serve people that are just great because of the way they were born and you need to serve them, or that I'm in touch with the person that created or the people that created this world and we give them the power, and we, you know, it's something they can relate of because it makes the people feel like they're a part of it.
That's what I'm saying. It's like in ancient Egypt, you know, they're the ruler, but they are also God. Like any royal person is ordained by God, or in this case, the seven of them. So when you start undercutting that, you're really starting to cut yourself off at your own heel. It's
right. Well, but I think their implication here would be that, like, look, these people are corrupt. And God has chosen, the gods have chosen someone to replace them.
So the gods were wrong. So they're wrong.
I don't think, well, I mean, that's obviously not how common people think, especially people that can't read and all that. But I don't think they have the same sort of doctrine that we have. And that's kind of a fairly new doctrine anyway, if you're thinking about like Christianity and stuff, that like all leaders are appointed by God. That's not, doesn't seem to be the system of the seven.
I'd say it still actually does fit.
And it's not a Christian thing.
Yeah, it's not. And I think it is actually what is being portrayed here. But I think you're right, Adam, that there could be a case where, you know, it's all about spin, right? It's about how the people that represent the faith spin, how, you know, this poor, frail, weak human erred, even though they were ordained by God. God or gods have taken back that privilege from them, and we need to find someone who is actually truly faithful and good.
He was never ordained by them, but do you see what I'm saying, though? It's like...
Oh, yeah, and I think it could easily backfire, right?
It's totally untenable for them to be doing this. It's not
a risk.
I don't think they've increased their force enough to make this work in the end. I don't think it will work. But
the only thing that I could see this like going the right way for them is if then they say, well, it's because these are false kings and queens, they should have never been on the throne, so we need to find a Targaryen.
Right. Or you know, whoever they pick. I don't know if
someone
Fagon happens to show up at the right moment, like maybe that's where this goes, where they're like, aha, the true king has returned. But you know, I don't know, that can't be in their mind at the moment, so they would probably just pick whoever they can manipulate
following a Targaryen under those circumstances. But otherwise it's like, how is anyone going to take this shit seriously anymore, you guys? You know what I mean? Like, they're all airing their dirty laundry.
They're shaming Cersei, who was the queen mother, and not, you know, Tommen, who is their actual king. You know, Cersei is dispensable in that sense. She is the evil counselor that needs to be discarded. So they're not necessarily going after the institution of the monarchy as if they went directly for Tommen.
That's a fair point, because one of the best things about Cersei chapters are being in her head and how crazy she is and how attached she's getting, and like how, you know, she believes the things going on around her don't quite line up. So like, we view her as kind of Queen Cersei because that's what she's been, but less and less I think the people look at her that way. And maybe the common people never really looked at her with that much power in the first place. It was always Robert, and it hasn't been that long since all that's gone down. Then her power was derived through Joffrey and now Tommen, obviously. She's done a lot of stuff behind the scenes that, you know, she's not putting out in the newspaper, right? Because it's not the kind of stuff that, you know, she wants people to know she did. So.
Yeah, that's a good point. I don't know. The whole thing to me, it always felt like they're just rapidly heading, barreling toward a cliff. Like, you know, pay no attention to the man behind the curtain. And then, oh, you're just a regular fucking dude.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, it's definitely a dangerous play. And like I said, I don't think it'll work out for them. I think it's going to end badly for everyone in this situation. I mean,
yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Full King's the other Landing. Thing is so crazy. Yeah. Like, you don't know what she'll do next. You know, like.
Well, in this chapter, they specifically say that Cersei, your end is at a rule. Your rule is at an end. So they're going on the assumption that she's not going to be doing any more ruling, which, unfortunately, Kevin takes a crossbow to the bowels. And so, by very slim chance, Cersei's back in power, most likely.
I don't think so, because Mace Tyrell is pretty firmly in hand of the king and wants to appoint his own people. I think he'll act quickly. Like, I think he's astute enough to realize that when Kevin's gone, he's got to put in someone like Tarly or someone, you know, one of his guys into that position.
Yeah. I think sometimes I forget that Mace Tyrell is not show Mace Tyrell and can actually do things.
Oh, he's still a buffoon in the books.
He's
not as bad as his dad.
He's less as bad as on the show. So, like, it's possible that he gets something done. But Cersei also moves really quickly and knows a lot of people in King's Landing. So, I mean, that'll be interesting to see how that plays out.
Well, I think
especially
something
with whatever Varys is going to do.
It's obviously a consistent theme throughout the series, and it's something that I think occurs in all these chapters. You know, of course, in the case of the Tyrion chapter, Tyrion at least is, you know, somewhat of a not, well, Tyrion and Jorah are, you know, kind of on their path, but then that goes wrong just because of a storm and the balance of power shifts and they're slaves now. In Jon Con's case, he even remarks on the fact that, like, he was just an exile, you know, a minute ago, but now he's a lord again. Just the idea that the balance of power and that the dynamics of power and who's in control can shift immediately, that is definitely something that can occur, and I think, you know,
right, until things settle, like, nothing's final. That's why, like, when in the last chapter, you know, Connington giving his speech about, you know, the Lord has returned and follow me, and I reading that, I was thinking, you know, about his vassals there. It's like, to them, it's like, okay, I guess, you know, this is the new regime. They just kind of go with it because what else are they going to do? But then 6 months, a year, a few weeks, whatever down the line, things go badly. Are they all getting executed, or are they, you know, hopefully the new lord is just like, all right, I'm keeping the staff on, you know?
Who do you think they will get to replace Kevin? Do you think it will be Randall Tarly?
Well, either that or one of his sons.
Cersei is still the queen regent, so Kevin was the lord regent that had assumed power, so I'm assuming Cersei goes right back into that spot as technically on top.
But he's the hand, though, too, right?
He's made Mace Tyrell the hand now.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, because Mace wants a ridiculous chair.
It's shaped like a hand.
Yeah, and all of it is about... I think all of it is about where people are in the immediacy. Like, even if someone like, you know, the Tarleys or someone has more power or can, you know, muster more power, like, whoever's in the Red Keep and can kind of start sending out ravens and get people on their side, you know, you don't need a lot of people to manage the Red Keep, right? Like, it's not like you need a whole host of armies like you do to run the city. It's like possession is 9/10 of the law sort of thing. So... Mm-hmm.
I still think the Tarleys are in cahoots with Aegon and Jon Con. I think that's their play.
I'd like that. I'd like
that's the Friends in the Reach or whatever.
I think it's them, but we'll see, obviously. It could be a lot of people.
Yeah.
Well, I was just going to say, I think it would be interesting if, like, Doran Martell came to court.
I think Doran is stuck in Dorne because he's in his wheelchair.
Right.
We'll see other Martells. Yeah, we'll see other Martells and the Bastards coming to King's Landing in court, but not Doran, I don't think.
Yeah, I do think the Martells are going to play significantly over the next book or so. Especially because of how much they talk about how Doran, you know, is weak and he won't do anything. And then we see he's actually been plotting.
With Jon Con and all that shit, right? Or no?
they want to be, Jon Kahn wants to send secret messages to Doran, and then from the preview chapters, we know that,
they've been in it together all along, though, right? Like,
they sent Arianne to go treat with them.
Arianne, yeah.
Yeah.
But that's not message, part of his whole deal.
The message Doran receives
When he, like, smacks her upside the head, he's like, dude, this shit's been going on, like, before you were even born, so just stop. Like, I couldn't even begin to explain it to you. You just
the original plan was to go with Viserys,
and Arya,
and then Daenerys, and now it's gonna be with Aegon, it seems.
Yeah.
So is that why everyone thinks it's a Aegon then?
Well, there's many reasons why people think Aegon might be a fake. Getting into all of them is a lot, but.
Because I always read it as, like, that's what he was talking about.
Because in one of the Winds of Winter chapters, they received a letter from John Connington, and it's like, I did not die, nor did Aegon. Like, these things are a revelation, and Doran is reacting as if this is a revelation, where he's like, I would weep for joy if I knew some part of Elia had survived. So it very much reads like Aegon was no one was anticipating Aegon as Varys intended.
Yeah, and it makes a ton of sense for Doran. It makes a ton of sense for Doran to go with them, especially when they find out what happened to Quentin. Like, it just makes total sense to go that way.
Quentin lives. 2020.
He doesn't, though.
But he does.
But he could. And Jane Westerling, the hips. And
he's fine.
Shut up.
And we could get wins.
He's totally fine.
That's the greatest of all hopes.
What was the latest George announcement, like a week or two ago, where he said that, like, after wins, he's writing the next Duncan Ed book before he gets to Dream of Spring? Which is probably a good idea.
He's writing the second half of Fire and Blood after wins.
No, that's coming out of Dream.
That would be after.
Oh, I mean, I don't believe him, but that's what he says.
Yeah, that's what he said.
No, he said the next book he publishes in the series is going to be Winds.
Yeah, he said Winds, then Duncan Egg, then Dream, then Fire and Blood.
Then Fire and Blood.
How about Winds, Dream, and then everything else?
I want Fire and Blood Part 2 towards
the end.
We had a whole thing on like Wild Cards a few episodes ago. But
Beating the Beast book.
So
I mean.
He's at Worldcon this weekend, so hopefully we'll get some kind of announcement or something.
Oh, is that this weekend?
Yeah.
Oh, shit. Okay.
Is that in San Francisco?
That's in Ireland.
That's in, we're at, like, DefCon 1 over here.
This isn't the Worldcon where, like, everyone's like, oh, he's going to trap himself in a cabin if it's not done. That's next.
That's next year, right? Okay, good.
Which would still be nothing, to be clear.
That's in New Zealand or something next year, right?
That's right.
Yeah, okay. I was like, holy crap, that came up quick.
Is he in any danger of reading an excerpt there or no?
I don't know. I mean, he has a speaking thing. I think they're inducting him into some kind of fucking Hall of Fame for taking his sweet-ass time. And let's see. What does Not a Blog say?
Oh, he's already given us like cards. 20 chapters. Shockers. So... I feel like there's a good chance that he rereads something he's already read, you know?
So. Fucking football season's coming up, so we're definitely screwed till at least February.
Oh, yeah, he's not going to write anything.
Oh, especially with how bad the Giants are going to be this year.
What are you talking about? Daniel Jones is the Messiah. Did you see he was 5 for 5 on his first drive?
No, I did not see that.
I just can't wait to see if Antonio Brown gets his helmet.
This is the intrigue that gets paid.
Oh my god! Now I'm sorry I brought it up.
Sorry. Yeah. Okay.
Well, don't look up Antonio Brown's recent comment about his feet. Then you'll be really sorry.
No. I hate football so much. I would rather never have wins than ever hear anything about fucking football again.
So 6:30 time is when his conversation with Maura McHugh in Dublin starts. So maybe check back tonight, check the interwebs and see what people are putting up.
your time.
I'm not 17th saying for anyone who's.
I'm not saying we're getting a publication date for Wins, but I'm just saying check back. That's all I'm saying.
I'm not saying it's aliens, but aliens.
All right. Tide comes in. Tide goes up.
And on that note, do we have anything else about Cersei and Kevin?
Nothing else.
Oh, I have some.
Jamie's
have
lost
some
in the Riverlands.
So when Cersei reacts to hearing that Myrcella has lost an ear, she's basically like, "Oh, she had such a pretty face."
Yeah,
now
she's
I'm not a parent.
Right.
Yeah, I'm not a parent. But yeah, no. I think if my child had been maimed horribly, I would be a bit more concerned. I'd be like, oh my God. I just think this contributes to evidence that Myrcella and Tommen were sort of sidelined while Joffrey got like all the corrupting influence and attention.
Because like one of the things like early on in the books is like the only thing that makes Cersei human is like her love for her children, and this was totally like, oh, she had a pretty face, like what kind of crazy that's like, you know,
she's like, oh, that's a shame. But, like,
I actually don't think it's that
pageant. Oh no,
I actually don't think it's that bad.
Yeah, maybe it is just like I'm missing like. She does care. I do get the sense she does genuinely care for Myrcella, but it just seemed like a strange reaction.
It might just be the first reaction, like that's the first thing, which might be bad on its own. The first thing she thinks of.
If it was someone else, I might be like, well, this isn't so bad, because I've known people that have, you know, had hardships with their children, and I think about my son. Like, that thought is maybe not too far from your mind if something like that happens. Like, oh my gosh, you know, poor kid, he was such a cute kid or something. You might think of it in that way. But once you know they're safe and everything's, you know, I don't know. There's still
less,
a lot
less
of
charitable with Cersei, I understand.
And yeah. With Cersei, it's sort of like, oh, I don't think she cares about the other stuff quite so much.
I think in the epilogue, too, like, Kevin tells her something and her first reaction is, Tyrion. Tyrion did it. Like,
always Tyrion. It reminds me of like the Night at the Roxbury where the guy's like, "Did you grab my ass?" And he's like, "Sir, I'm down the street." Like he's on the cell phone. He's like, "I couldn't possibly have done that."
Standing across the room, you can see my hands.
Yeah, she's just like Tyrion. Tyrion did everything. They're like, I don't think Tyrion could have done this, but we'll investigate.
Everything is Tyrion. Like, he has become, like, a snark or grumpkin to her. Like, he's just lurking behind every shadow.
Well, the great thing is it's true for Tyrion as well. It's like this, like, twin. Like, they're haunting each other. It's so, so twisted.
They're going full Kylo Ren and Rey.
Yeah.
Mind melds.
No, I don't think
she's going to see Tyrion shirtless.
Their own, they're just connecting within their own mind prisons.
Yeah, she's
like,
is really flipping about it.
Belt
she's like,
so high on his waist.
She's like, oh, her face
Tyrion's
is
Tyrion's chest. Wow.
Shame, but I've got bigger problems over here. Like, maybe it could be that because she's just like not really in a position to do much about it. So, like, what would freaking out help anybody?
I loved her reaction like a while back to the when they brought the dwarf head or whatever. And she was like, this obviously isn't him, but I don't want to, like, be too harsh and then no one brings me more dwarf heads because I don't really care about the dwarf heads. But I obviously can't, like, reward them for this. <It's> like... She's like, I have to still maintain some incentive for future murders that hopefully will be Tyrion while punishing these people.
Do you think that her concern is more like, oh, well, she was pretty, and now I won't be able to, like, marry her off to my advantage.
I think, if anything, it just speaks to the way that, you know, you think of what, just a woman in the society, like, that being her, like, prime virtue as a person.
Well, I think she views herself through her kids a little bit, you know, like, especially Myrcella, because that's the only girl. I don't even know if she'd really want to be marrying her off, necessarily. Like, she didn't want to be married off. I think she probably be pretty resistant to the idea.
Yeah, I guess that's true. But that would mean that she actually cares about Myrcella more than she cares about herself, which I don't think is the case.
Well, no, but I think that comes back to, like, you know, living vicariously through your children, where, like, if she had the power to decide whether or not Myrcella can get married off, and that situation were to come up, you know, Marcella didn't want to get married off. She's like, well, I didn't want to be married off either, so I'm not going to let that happen to my daughter, kind of thing. Like, you know, correcting her own past through her child instead of actually caring about Marcella.
That shit makes me so sad. Like, when Ariane does all that, it's like, oh man, if only you could just like talk to Cersei about it, I bet you she'd be into it. You know what I mean? Like, cause she just so desperately wants to be the queen, and that's like a chance to live vicariously that way through Marcella. I feel like they're on the same page. They're just, they don't
know. Yeah. That whole plot is ill-conceived. And,
no, I think it went well.
Someone tells
us. It went
it's
okay.
It's really all about
that's Barry's own part. Great.
All about
it worked out for Cersei. So when Cersei is being questioned by the High Septon, something I thought was very presumptuous is when they then ask, oh, and by the way, are your kids incest babies? Because that was just... all the other things come from what Lancel and the Kettleblacks have confessed, but this one is just like, oh, and there's some rumors going round.
There were ravens sent out.
Yeah.
It's very hypocritical, right? Because they point out that Stannis is obviously a godless heathen, but he's the one who spread the rumor. So it's like, why you got to pick your line here, guys. Like, which do you believe?
They're a religion. They don't really have to do that.
Yeah. No, it's obviously expected, but it is very hypocritical.
And I mean, let's be honest, they are incest babies. It's pretty obvious.
Like, like in passing, oh, by the by, any chance you fucked your brother resulting in these three children?
Can I interest you in confessing to this abomination? No? Next item. Yeah, like I don't know. And so I did the Cersei, I read the other chapters in the Cersei chapter. I was like, I was in a hurry. I had a flat tire, so I had to get the car fixed. And so I was like, I'll do the Dotrice. So I'll listen to it. And like, he does the High Septon. Like, I don't think he did this in the previous books, but he does his like Tyrion leprechaun voice. I'm like, wait, what just happened? This is not the version of the High Septon that is in my head or that I thought you did in the previous books. So...
What's that? Roy Dotrice did a bad voice?
Never. Whoa.
Not no more, he don't.
Confess it to your kind, Cersei.
I liked your voices, Roy.
R.I.P. Roy. Anyone who speaks badly of Roy, shame on you. I mean, you're right, but...
I'm just going to pop in and say hi, just because I've been lurking here for like 5 minutes waiting for a lull, and I feel kind of awkward doing that. So.
Oh, hey, Abby.
Hi, I got off of work a little early, so I am here now.
Nice.
But you guys seem to be finishing up Cersei, right? That's the last chapter.
Yeah, we're just about wrapping up. So,
do you have any thoughts on any of the chapters you want to throw out?
Yeah, anything you want to throw at us?
Not really.
Good contribution. Glad to have you on.
Glad you
solid work.
I don't know. I thought maybe I would
I'll
be able
just,
to
like,
join.
Just like add Jock to the title too.
Yeah.
I thought I might be able to like jump in and then like pick up on what you guys are talking about and be like, oh yes, my opinion on that topic, but alas, what's not to happen.
Sadly, we went through these chapters pretty quickly. I mean, I think we were basically done about 20 minutes ago. Like, this will cut down to less than an hour. The first two chapters were not, you know.
Yeah.
What do you think about Fagon? Real or fakesies?
Oh my god, I don't even have like an opinion on that, just because he's so I just don't care enough about that whole plot that I don't have a
fair
like,
enough.
I don't care if he's real. I don't really care if he's fake.
You know it's gonna go nowhere regardless. So
like it could go somewhere and like maybe it'll be interesting, but I don't really understand why everyone is so obsessed with John Connington. Like I'm just like
we
I don't really
that.
Yeah.
It's
weird.
I don't know. I do know that I didn't read the chapters because I knew I wasn't going to be able to join the whole call, but I just know that I hate all of Tyrion's dance chapters a lot.
We talked about that too.
Yep. Yeah.
You're right on sync with us.
Okay, great.
Simpatico here. Yeah.
Okay, cool. Is this the Tyrion one where
is that a llama in your picture?
Yeah, it's me with a llama when I'm like 13.
That's crazy. Okay.
My overnight camp had a llama, and I took a picture with it.
I like Tyrion's dance chapters.
I like the end of... I like his dance chapters when he's with... what's the yellow whale guy?
Yezin.
So I like his last two, I think. But otherwise, I really don't care for that.
Where you feel like he's closer to being part of the plot again.
Yeah.
And he's also cleaning up a ton of shit.
I mean, I think what was the first thing we said about Tyrion's chapter that you probably just could have cut it all out. So.
I like his dynamic with Penny though.
Oh, I do not care about her at all. I like that she has the pig and the dog, and I think it's really cute. And that's about it.
Not them doing anything. I just like the perspective that he gets from her. Like, he's always brooding and my life is a piece of shit and everyone hates me. And then with Penny, it's it could be worse
too. Yeah, but I feel like we've had that with so many other characters that it's just I feel like this one is so on the nose where it's like, Tyrion doesn't realize how bad he's had it, or how good he's had it.
Yeah, we said that too.
Fair point. Yeah. Abby, you're syncing with us perfectly.
You were just amazing. Were you on this podcast the whole time?
Yeah, I was kidding. You can just put me in when you guys are talking about this.
I could edit these bits way back.
That's so much effort.
It would be very interesting.
Yeah.
Or I'll just put it in the after show. It's much easier.
But yeah, I guess she kind of helps advance the plot enough where I can't hate her, but there probably could have been much easier ways. Actually, no, does she help advance the plot at all? Not really. No, it's Jorah. It's all Jorah. Never mind. She doesn't do anything.
Her assassination attempt of Tyrion gets them on the ship to Meereen. Oh. So if that counts.
That counts, yeah, that works.
And she'll try again later.
And Jorah needs to die. Jorah needs to die.
Yeah.
Creepy old hairy dude that is obsessed with a 13-year-old. So.
Yeah. Not a fun time.
Hey, Daenerys is 16 now. That's much more acceptable.
She's she's maybe 15.
Is he really that old though? Isn't he in his 30s?
No, he's not Ian Glenn.
He doesn't need to be super old or anything. Like, if he's 25, it's still creepy.
Yeah.
But he's old. He's
it'd be creepy.
Significantly older than her.
If I, a 20-year-old, was dating a 16-year-old, that'd be creepy.
But only in these.
Not
times.
In their world.
Yeah.
In their world, it's basically for women, if you're outside of your teens and you're not already betrothed, you're probably just done. She's an old maid at 21,
Well, because they only have childhood and adulthood. There's no intermediate years, so.
Right. And childhood ends at as soon as the first famine or at 12.
Hey, Bran's almost a man grown when he's 8, so.
I don't really know how they decide when men are adults, but I know it's women. It's when they have their first period or something. I don't know what they decide when, how men decide.
Which is terrible way to, when you get hair on your chest, which I guess for Mormont was probably at 9.
No, I think it's definitely the testicles, because some people don't get chest hair.
But yeah, even with the society's expectations, this is creepy.
Let us parse when it is not creepy.
Can you just title this test?
The point is that Jorah's done. I mean, his utility for the plot, I think, is just about done, and I'm sure they'll keep him around longer. But
I think he could go. Yeah.
Oh my god, I'm so over him.
he'll help Tyrion get to a audience with Dany, and then I think after that, he's not. There's nothing you can do with him really anymore because.
In the preview chapter, he seems to get signs of life there.
Oh, okay. I haven't read the preview chapter, so I have no idea. I don't care about spoilers. I haven't read it, so.
Well, it doesn't really spoil anything. He just kills a dude.
Everybody turned into a bear.
Tyrion.
Then Gandalf showed up. I can't wait for A Dream of Spring with, like, you know, wizards with pointy hats just everywhere. You know, like, where did they come from?
Shit's just what's exploding.
West of Westeros?
Flooding out of the Citadel. Just
they're the, that's what Trouble. The Hightower is. It's just the wizard school.
Yeah, it's actually Hogwarts is like.
Yeah.
We've sea monsters waiting. Climbing out of the sea and just destroying everything. Yeah.
A raven has arrived. You've been accepted to the King's Landing School of Dark Mages and Wizardry.
You're a maester, Harry.
Oh, okay. Oh, Jesus Christ.
Would that make Hagrid like Qyburn because he got like kicked out of the Mages
School? Oh, I like it.
Maybe like Holden Halfmaester?
Yeah, he keeps his links in his umbrella.
Yeah, all right. We're done.
Okay. I'm glad I could contribute so much.
Yeah. Hey, this was fun.
That was the best part of the whole cast, actually.
How dare you? So, thank you guys for joining me. That was a lot of fun. Quick chapters. I know, you know, not the most exciting stuff, but we get some good chapters next week. Our next episode, which I believe Bina will be hosting. We're going to be doing Theon 4, which is The Prince of Winterfell, The King's Prize, which is Asha's second chapter, and The Walk of Shame, Cersei's second chapter. So these are, you know, that's actually a nice set of chapters. Should have signed up for those. All right. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks,
bye-bye.
Everyone.
Cheers.
I don't know if you want me to sign off or not, because I don't know if I'm going to appear at all, so.
Just I hope you do. That's right. My hope.
Yeah, thank you.
And introducing Abby. Goodbye, Abby.
Bye.
Goodbye, Abby.
Yeah. I hope you do get spliced through randomly.
Someone ask George what a fucking Warlock's Maze is. Zach failed us.
I missed my chance.
God damn it.
And you know who else failed us? Greg.
Yeah.
Yep.
He did.
Like always. But I did get a signed copy of Game of Thrones, so he did not fail me.
I did too, which was great. But he got all those damn books signed, and they were like, don't ask about anything. Like, he'll talk to you about wild cards, but don't ask about, you know, the books or how he's writing. You know, you just leave him alone. And I'm like, the perfect thing would have been like, so hey, that Warlock's Maze, by the way, like, you got anything on that?
If you would not remember that, you would have no idea.
He'd be like, was that, is that in my book? Or was that in Wild Cards? I don't remember a Warlock's Maze.
It was a just, cheap pilot just, that got like, interested.
I'm hoping that like there's some story behind it where it's like something from his youth and he was like, oh yeah, the Warlock's Maze, you know. So the Warlock's Maze, it's made of hedges. It starts off made of hedges, but as you get closer, it's made of trees.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, I don't need that kind of detail. I'm just curious where he came up with it. That's all. Oh, all right, guys.